Recordings may be available for purchase. You mean your final edited version, right?
Yes, the final edited version. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Congress is appointing an independent commission to rethink the role of the CIA and to consider whether it should continue to exist at all. Meanwhile, the agency is still reeling from the arrest of Soviet mole Aldrich Ames. On today's Fresh Air, we examine the condition of the CIA with New York Times reporter Tim Weiner. Also, we talk with Greg Saris, the author of a new collection of short stories about Native Americans, and a biography of Mabel McKay, an Indian basket weaver and healer who Saris knew for over 30 years. Saris is the elected chief of the Miwok tribe. And TV critic David Bianculli tells us about his new satellite dish. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Administration officials say Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy plans to resign. Espy has been under investigation by the Justice Department for allegedly accepting gifts from people and companies which do business with his agency. Espy is a former congressman from Mississippi and one of four blacks in the Clinton administration. Espy has scheduled a news conference to begin about half an hour from now. Crowds of jubilant Haitians swarmed into the headquarters of a hated pro-army militia today after American troops raided the building. The U.S. troops seized weapons and arrested dozens of people. NPR's Suni Khalid has more from Port-au-Prince.
Several thousands of people had swarmed into the streets at the Normandy Hotel, which is where the FRAP headquarters were. And what people were doing were they were going into the offices, ransacking them, throwing out the office equipment, chairs, everything, and basically busting it into little pieces. They also took mimeographed copies of the portraits of former president for life François Duvalier, Papa Doc, and his son Jean-Claude Duvalier, Baby Doc. They were taking these pictures and throwing them in the air. People were grabbing the pictures and ripping them in shreds.
NPR's Suni Khalid. The raid came hours after Haitians in western Haiti shot and wounded a U.S. Special Forces soldier. He is the second American to be injured since U.S. troops arrived in Haiti 2 weeks ago. Underwater photos reveal the bow door of the ferry Estonia was completely detached, allowing water to flood into the ship. The ferry sank last week off the coast of Finland, killing more than 900 people. Investigators say a locking device on the movable door had failed. A version of the Honda Civic is the country's most fuel-efficient car. That's according to the Environmental Protection Agency. NPR's Philip Davis has more.
The EPA says the subcompact Honda Civic HBVX gets 47 miles to the gallon in the city and a frugal 56 miles a gallon during highway driving. Runner-up is General Motors' Geo Metro. The Metro and its twin, the Suzuki Swift, get 44 miles to the gallon in the city and 51 miles to the gallon on the highway. The EPA says average fuel economy for new cars seems to be holding steady at about 28 miles a gallon. On the low end, three dozen models are branded gas guzzlers. The worst car in that respect was the Lamborghini Diablo, which gets only 9 miles a gallon in the city, 14 on the highway. Environmentalists, though, note that more than half of the increasingly popular pickups and other light trucks get less than 20 miles per gallon, and many get less than 15. This is Philip Davis reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 1.5 points at 38.45. Trading so far today has been heavy. 258 million shares have changed hands. This is National Public Radio News in Washington. President Clinton today urged Congress not to waste any time in passing a new GATT World Trade Treaty. The president told a group of business and congressional leaders that Treasury Department estimates indicate a six-month delay would cost $70 billion in growth through the end of the decade. The treaty would lower trade tariffs worldwide. Senate leaders have agreed to hold a special session following the November congressional elections to vote on GATT legislation. The Senate has failed to pass a supplementary funding bill for the Securities and Exchange Commission. NPR's Greg Peppers reports that could hamper the agency as it tries to police the securities industry.
The SEC's budget has encountered extensive trouble in Congress this year. A dispute over whether the agency should become self-funded left it with a fraction of the $306 million it requested to operate for 1995. Congress moved to fix the problem last week, with the House passing a supplemental funding bill to give the SEC authority to raise about $180 million, which would restore the full funding. But the supplemental funding bill ran into trouble last Friday due to a Republican senator's attempt to attach an unrelated amendment. The bill was supposed to move easily through both chambers this week and get signed by President Clinton. SEC's Director of Legislative Affairs, Catherine Fulton, says the Senate's inability to pass the funding bill means the agency will impose a hiring freeze and eliminate non-essential travel beginning today. The SEC supervises the nation's financial markets, including thousands of brokerage dealers and brokers. The chairman of the Senate Banking Committee warned the budget impasse eventually could place the markets and the personal savings of millions of individual investors at risk. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
Actress Harriet Nelson has died. She starred as the All-American Mom on TV's Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet during the 1950s and 60s. Harriet Nelson was 85. I'm Ann Bozell, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The CIA is in trouble. It's been accused of incompetence for allowing Aldrich Ames to remain in the agency years after clues indicated he might be a Soviet mole. The agency is also under attack for its sexist culture. And Congress is about to appoint an independent commission to rethink the CIA's role, its structure, power, and budget, and whether it should continue to exist at all. My guest Tim Weiner covers the CIA for the New York Times. He is also the author of the book Blank Check, The Pentagon's Black Budget. We asked him to review what's happening with the CIA. I asked what happened to the plan CIA Director James Woolsey was supposed to come up with to redefine the agency in the post-Cold War world.
Jim Woolsey wears two hats, okay? And I'm sure he wishes at times that he had two heads. He has to run the Central Intelligence Agency, and he is chairman of the board of all U.S. intelligence agencies, as well as being the CEO of the CIA. And he has been asked repeatedly to come up with some overarching vision for the entire U.S. intelligence community, and Congress has sort of now taken that away from him in the form of this commission. As for the CIA, well, there are a lot of problems out there now. The Aldrich Ames spy case, which broke 8 months ago, has really damaged morale. Not so much his treason, but the picture of almost unbelievable incompetence that has emerged as the agency essentially confesses that it was told back in 1986, a few months after Ames began to spy for the Soviet Union, that he was probably a very bad man and, in essence, for the next 7 years did very, very little about it.
Well, Woolsey last week decided not to single out anyone in the CIA to take the fall for the failure to get rid of Aldrich Ames, and no one's going to be dismissed or demoted, although there were 11 letters of reprimand sent to former and present CIA officials. How is that playing in the intelligence community?
Well, you have to appreciate the difficulty of his position. He has to at once confess error publicly. And in fairness, errors had happened largely before he took over CIA in February 1993. And he has to try not to further damage morale at this very battered agency. It's a very, very difficult position, and I'm sure that he feels that it was an almost impossible one.
You say that the CIA is seen as incompetent for not getting Aldrich Ames sooner. What were the early signs that something was wrong with his performance?
Well, it's a long litany. Rick Ames joined the CIA in 1962. He was a legacy, so to speak. His father had been in the agency. He had a remarkably undistinguished career, first serving overseas in Turkey, then returning to the United States, working for a time in the 1970s in New York, focused on the United Nations, and then a truly disastrously bad tour in the CIA's station in Mexico City in 1981, 82, and early 83. At the time he returned to Washington in 1983, he was undergoing a messy divorce from a former CIA officer. He was sleeping with a foreigner whom he later married, who had been a recruited agent of the CIA. That's against the rules. He was broke. He was drunk most of the time. He was a slacker. He had a reputation as Deadwood, a somewhat derelict employee, and he had dangerously unorthodox views about the way of the world.
Like what?
Well, he now says, and I've interviewed him at length, that he had an emerging vision that it would be better for the world if the Soviet if the spies that the CIA had inside the Soviet Union were to disappear, that if they were to disappear, then reformers, should they come, could convincingly argue that the problems of communism were self-inflicted and not the result of an American plot. It's a twisted and very self-justifying argument, but he says it was growing inside his head at this time period. This would be 83 or so. So what does the CIA do with this lazy, incompetent, arrogant, drunken employee? It gives him one of the most sensitive jobs in the shop, which is running the counterintelligence branch of the Soviet division of the clandestine service.
How was he recruited by the Soviets?
He recruited himself. He walked into the Soviet embassy in April 1985. He was authorized at the time to go to the Soviet embassy to attempt to recruit officials there. And he sat down with an embassy officer, and he, in exchange for $50,000, sold them the names of two Soviets who were secretly working for the United States. Several months later, he showed up and, he says, voluntarily, essentially gave them the keys to the kingdom, a list of names of every important Soviet intelligence officer, military officer, and private citizen who was secretly working for the United States.
And some of them were killed.
At least 10 died. Ames then says, to his surprise, the Soviets told him they had set aside $2 million in gratitude. The intelligence relationship continued for the next 8.5 years.
So as a result of his work with the Soviets, Ames comes into a lot of money, and he spends that money in very ostentatious ways. He buys a Jaguar, he buys a new real expensive home.
For cash.
For cash, okay. And the CIA doesn't investigate it. What did he tell the CIA about how he got the money?
He was confronted with this in 1990. A fellow employee had raised a red flag, and not the first, about Ames, saying essentially, good God, how did this man come into this money? And Ames says that he explained that his wife, Rosario, had come into a fortune from the death of her father. The CIA then belatedly mounts a search the next year for the will of her father in Colombia. And after a apparently very half-hearted and hapless effort, decides it can't find it. It's worse than this. In 1985, Ames, who, as we said, was authorized to visit the Soviet embassy in Washington as part of his job, stops reporting his visits to the embassy. He's showing up at the Soviet embassy without clearing it with his superiors. Now, if you're in the clandestine service, you want your bosses to know that you are visiting the Soviet embassy, that you are doing your job. This is how you get your ticket punched. So for Ames, to not report these visits could mean only two things. One, that he was uninterested in advancing his career, or two, that he was a spy for the Soviet Union. In 1985, the FBI, which was regularly monitoring the Soviet embassy in Washington, asked the CIA, hey, how come your guy is making all these visits? Ames is confronted with this, does nothing, the CIA forgets about it. So the flag was raised, really, 8 years before Ames was caught.
What's the CIA's explanation for not ferreting Ames out sooner?
It is a remarkably detailed and remarkably self-critical self-portrait of incompetence and indifference. Its explanation begins with the fact that it kept promoting Ames because people wanted to get rid of him because he was such a rotten employee. So they'd fob him off on another division, in this case, tragically, the Soviet division, in 1983 onward. This is a standard bureaucratic practice known as turkey farming, to get rid of an unwanted employee. It says it failed to focus on this direct evidence because there was almost a reluctance to concede that there might be a traitor within and that the traitor might be one of us. I talked with a longtime FBI counterintelligence officer about this, and he said, well, you go to the CIA and tell them you're penetrated, and they say, no, we're not. You go back and you say, you're penetrated. There is a traitor in your ranks. And they say, well, it's probably a technical problem. It's probably a bug or a wiretap somewhere, but it can't be a person. And the FBI guy sighed and said, well, it almost always is a person.
Do you think that the CIA was reluctant to admit that there might be a turncoat within the agency because it would make the agency look bad?
That is conceivable. That is conceivable. The consequences of catching him were comparable to the consequences of not catching him. Do you follow me?
Right, that they'd be hurt either way. And so it is one theory that people who were in more powerful positions in the CIA maybe had more to lose by exposing the spy than allowing him to continue?
You have to remember that there was a lot of other stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in 1986, according to the former director of Central Intelligence, Bob Gates, who I spoke to about this, by 1986, within a year after Ames has given up most of the keys to the kingdom, the network of Soviet agents working for the CIA begins to fall apart. People begin disappearing. People begin dying. And it was as if searchlights lit up the Kremlin saying, you're penetrated. There is a spy in your ranks. Now, almost simultaneously with this, the CIA's role in the cash for the Contras and arms for the Ayatollah machinations of the Iran-Contra affair are beginning to become unraveled. People were, to say the least, distracted. Several months later, William J. Casey, the head of the CIA under Ronald Reagan, falls into a coma as a consequence of a brain tumor that kills him. Within a few weeks, there's an enormous to-do at the Soviet embassy in Moscow. Wiretaps, bugs have been discovered. Perhaps the Marine Guards there have been working with the Soviets. One can understand the failure to focus in this period. What is harder to understand is that from 1987 to 1991, the head of the CIA was William Webster, the former head of the FBI. And one could not imagine a person better situated to make FBI-CIA cooperation in a matter like this take place, to make sure that it took place. This is when the mole hunt essentially ceased. And that is still an unexplained chapter in this story.
Meanwhile, what are the current proposals to try to make sure that if there is a next time like this, the CIA turns the information over promptly to the FBI so that the FBI can investigate
right.
who the mole is?
Congress has put this into law in the intelligence bill for next year. The bill passed Congress last week.
My guest is Tim Weiner. He covers the CIA for the New York Times. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the CIA with New York Times reporter Tim Weiner. Now, there's another current case that's calling into question operations within the CIA, and I'm thinking of the gender discrimination case. Do you want to tell us about that one?
Sure. The case in question is a federal suit styled Jane Doe Thompson versus R. James Woolsey. The woman in question had a stellar career, by all accounts, at the CIA and rose to become the first woman to be appointed station chief in a Latin American country. She was sent down to Jamaica in 1991 as station chief. She inherited a real snake pit, as the way she describes it in her suit. A lot of head cases. The place was a dumping ground for some misfits who worked at the agency. When she attempted to discipline them, they then turned the tables on her and mounted a series of what she says are false allegations that she had suddenly become a heavy drinking sexual temptress, which everyone who knows her says is out of character. That's not the woman they know. Then to further complicate matters, the agency said, great job in Jamaica, we're going to make you station chief in Prague, which is a very prominent position. That offer was withdrawn, she says, after her deputy-to-be said, I will not work for a woman. The combination of what she says are the false allegations against her of personal sexual excesses and excessive drinking and this withdrawal of this proffered promotion have put her in limbo in a windowless cubicle at CIA headquarters. And when I began to look into her story, I began to get an outpouring of calls from people who had been her bosses at CIA, who had worked with her at CIA. Many went on the record for the first time in their lives or submitted to the first interview they'd ever done in their lives and allowed their names to be used and said, this is a great woman and she's being done an injustice.
What do you know now about what the CIA has been authorized to do in Haiti?
Well, the New York Times has reported that it's been authorized to carry out a limited series of programs that could help get the parliament up and running and could help the carry out the policy of the return of President Aristide. In the past, the agency has had links, which it has severed now, with some key members of the anti-Aristide junta, and it's a very good argument to make that it should have had those links since it could figure out what was going on better by getting reports from these guys. The problem becomes when you're relying on Aristide's opponents as reporting, as reporters, as sources of information, will that skew or bias your reporting on Aristide? And such allegations have been made fairly convincingly.
The CIA did a psychological profile of Aristide and said he was basically mentally unstable. I know that conclusion has been challenged. What do you know about how that conclusion was reached?
There are a number of problems with the psychological portrait of President Aristide that the agency produced. One allegation in it, which is that he had been treated for depression or mental illness at a Canadian hospital in 1980, is demonstrably false. Very sympathetic portraits of President Aristide, such as Amy Wilentz's in her book The Rainy Season, acknowledge that he had bouts of depression, that he had spells of emotional weakness or instability, if you will. But you could say that about a lot of foreign leaders. It certainly doesn't make him unqualified to hold office. The agency, it should be remembered, is an instrument of American foreign policy. And where American foreign policy is clear and coherent, the agency doesn't get crossways with it. In recent months, years, if you will, when American foreign policy has been somewhat confused on a number of issues because no one really knows where we're going after the Cold War or how to get there, the agency can be seen as somehow separate from the American foreign policy establishment. By and large, it's not. The CIA has always been a tool of American foreign policy. And with very few exceptions, very, very, very few exceptions, the agency has never been a rogue elephant, in that famous phrase from the 1970s. Where it has sinned and where it has erred, it's not because it was a rogue elephant. It's because there was a rogue mahout, a rogue elephant driver, and that was the President of the United States. The coups the CIA engineered in the past, the botched assassination attempts the early 1960s. These things were carried out at the direction of the White House, and they were not some sort of sinister secret plot that the agency did on its own. The problems, some of the problems that the CIA is experiencing now, are because it is a Cold War tool that has not been substantially reshaped for the post-Cold War world, and that it is an instrument of American foreign policy at a time when American foreign policy is confused.
What's President Clinton's relationship with the agency like now?
To the best anyone can figure, it's at a remove. The president's national security advisor, Tony Lake, is said to rely more on the State Department's intelligence analyses than on CIA's. Mr. Lake, of course, comes out of the State Department. Mr. Woolsey isn't, he doesn't have a seat at the table on a number of occasions where his predecessors would have. It's a difficult and sometimes strained relationship to the best of anyone's knowledge.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Pleasure, Terry.
Tim Weiner covers the CIA for the New York Times. He's also the author of Blank Check, The Pentagon's Black Budget. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with Greg Saris. His new collection of short stories is about contemporary California Indians. He's also the author of a new biography of a Native American healer and basket weaver who Saris knew for over 30 years. Saris was adopted as a child and didn't discover that he was part Native American until he was an adult. Now he's the elected chief of the Miwok tribe. And our TV critic David Bianculli just got a satellite dish. He'll tell us what he's been watching. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy has scheduled a news conference to begin at this hour. White House officials say, well, he will announce his resignation. Espy has been under investigation by the Justice Department for allegedly accepting gifts from people and companies doing business with his agency. Espy has admitted some errors in judgment, but denies that any of his actions influence department policy. An international commission has been viewing videotapes of the sunken ferry Estonia, trying to learn why the ship went down, killing 900 people. Investigators told a news conference in Finland today that the bow door was completely detached from the rest of the vessel and has not been located. The BBC's Christopher Guinness reports.
Behind the front bow door, the visor, there is another ramp along which the cars would have passed to get onto the ship. Now, according to the video camera, about 1 meter along the top edge of that has been broken away. That would suggest that the sealing on the door of the bow of the ship was defective in some way, and it's that that let on water, which eventually destabilized the vessel. The senior officials in the commission made it quite clear they believe that that is where the problem which caused this disaster was located. It's clear that the locking mechanism of those doors were in some way defective. That caused the door to open.
Christopher Guinness reporting from Finland. American forces this morning seized the headquarters of a pro-army militia group in Port-au-Prince. The headquarters was the site of violent clashes between militiamen and pro-democracy demonstrators last week. At least 5 Haitians were shot or beaten to death there on Friday. The raid came just hours after Haitians with military weapons shot and wounded a U.S. soldier in western Haiti. He's a member of the Army Special Forces and is in stable condition following surgery. President Clinton has lifted the ban on contacts between the U.S. and Sinn Féin, the political arm of the Irish Republican Army. UPI's Carol Van Dam has more.
In a written statement, the president says he is lifting the ban so that a dialogue between the U.S. and Sinn Féin can begin. The U.S. has had a long-standing policy of prohibiting all contacts with Sinn Féin. A month after Sinn Féin announced all hostilities would cease, the U.S. began to review that policy. Vice President Al Gore notified Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams in a phone call this morning that the ban was, in fact, being lifted. Adams is scheduled to meet with mid-level U.S. officials at the State Department tomorrow to discuss the peace process. Additional meetings are to take place in Northern Ireland. Carol Van Dam, the White House.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials rose 3.70 to close at 3846.89. This is NPR News in Washington. South African President Nelson Mandela told the United Nations General Assembly today that democracy cannot survive in his country without international help. He told delegates that just as the UN used sanctions to help end apartheid, it must band together to fuel economic recovery in South Africa. Mandela will also use his trip to the U.S. to seek American investment in his country. Cardinals, bishops, nuns, and religious experts are taking part in a month-long synod at the Vatican. The focus will be on the role of priests and nuns in the modern world. NPR's Sylvia Pagioli reports.
In the weeks leading up to the assembly, Catholic women's associations voiced the hope that women be given greater responsibilities and decision-making power in the church. And the Synod's main working document says it's urgent to recognize with more precision and in an official manner the role that women carry out in the church. Last spring, a survey of Catholic female religious orders said nuns want more power in the church, better pay, and more senior jobs in the Vatican Curia. But in a mass officially opening the synod yesterday, Pope John Paul II indirectly reiterated the church ban on women priests by referring to previous documents which uphold the hierarchical structure of the church and rule out the ordination of women on the grounds that Christ chose only men as his apostles. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Rome.
The Exxon Oil Corporation has filed suit to reverse or reduce verdicts on damages stemming from the Exxon Valdez oil spill. The motions were filed in federal court in Anchorage, Alaska. Exxon's chairman says the company will use every legal means to overturn the verdicts, especially the one requiring the company to pay $5 billion in punitive damages. The Commerce Department reports construction spending fell 0.2% in August. That is the first decline in 6 months. I'm Ann Bozell, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Greg Saris is the elected chief of the Miwok Indians in California. His new collection of short stories, Grand Avenue, is about contemporary California Indians. Writer Michael Dara says it's not only one of the very best works of fiction by and about Native Americans, it's one of the most important imaginative books of the year, period. Saris has also written a new biography of a Native American healer and basket weaver who he knew for over 30 years. It's called Mabel McKay, Weaving the Dream. Greg Saris' own ethnic heritage is part Indian, part Filipino, part Jewish. He was adopted by white parents as a baby and didn't even know his ethnic identity until he was an adult. I asked him to read a short excerpt from his new book, Grand Avenue.
This is from the first story called The Magic Pony, and the narrator is a 15-year-old girl named Jasmine, and she's talking about her situation there, and she says, "Us Indians are full of evil," Auntie Faye said. She told lots of stories about curses and poison. We call it poison. Not that we're bad people, not like regular thieves and murderers. We inherit it. Something our ancestors did, maybe, or something we did to bring it on ourselves. Something we didn't realize, like having talked about somebody in a way they didn't like, so they got mad and poisoned you. She knew a lot about poison. She said she had an instinct for it. She'd nod with her chin to a grove of trees. "Don't walk there," she'd say. Her eyes looked dark and motionless, like she was seeing something she didn't want to see and couldn't look away from. She traced poison in a family. Take the receptionist at Indian Health, who has a black birthmark the size of a quarter on her cheek. Faye said the woman's mother stole something from someone, so the woman was marked from birth. It happens like that. It can circle around and get someone in your family. It's everywhere, Faye said.
Where does this come from, this idea, poison? Did you grow up with people thinking that people had the poison?
Yes, well, poison, the whole notion of poison is endemic in California, Central California Indian culture. In the Plains culture, you might call it bad medicine, or in the Southwest, they call it witchery. But here in California, we call it poison. And everything in nature, we believe, is potentially good, Terry, and also potentially bad. It can poison you. You do something wrong, you mishandle the environment, you mishandle other human beings, that poison will get you and curse you, and it can live with you for generations in your family.
Well, I think this might lead us to Mabel McKay, the woman about who you just wrote a biography, and she was a basket weaver and healer, the last of her tribe and the last to speak that tribe's language.
Right.
And I'd like for you to tell us about her dream, which she said revealed the powers that she was given to heal and weave baskets.
When I mean dream with Mabel, and when we call a leader a dreamer, that means the dream is the way she communicates directly with the spirit or with the creator. And she was given that dream, or the dream the spirit came to her, when she was 5 years old, a young girl, and she began training then through the spirit, dreaming. And the dream the spirit, through the dream, the spirit tells her everything about her baskets, what she was going to weave, who she was going to doctor, how she was going to deal with the sickness, what songs to sing, where and when to gather her materials. It directed her entire life and those around her. For instance, she was a world-renowned basket weaver with baskets in the Smithsonian, and people would want to flop down $5,000 for a basket, and she wouldn't take the money because unless the dream came for that particular person, she wouldn't weave. So she'd have them write their name in a ledger, and at night before she went to bed, or in the morning before she began to weave, she'd run her finger down the page, and if the dream or the spirit didn't speak, the person didn't get their basket.
In the dream, the spirit also told her that she had a special throat to suck out illness.
Yes, Terry.
And then she could spit the illness into the baskets that she wove.
Yeah, she had a special basket for the disease, to spit the disease in. Each basket she wove had a purpose. I have a miniature basket. There was baskets for prophecy. There's one that she wove in 1959. She gave to her partner, medicine partner, Essie Parrish. And she said, one day that basket will be dropping pitch. It'll be sweating. And at that time, a terrible pestilence will come and affect a lot of young people, particularly young men. And she wove that in 59, and in 78, and the winter of 78 and 79, that basket began dropping pitch. So, see, these baskets were associated with prophecy. You mentioned her throat. She was given what we call an extra tongue, and she was the last, as far as I know, in the whole continent here, the last of the American Indians, to be what we call a sucking doctor. And in the old days, the sucking doctor was the most powerful because she would take the disease out. She would go into trance, locate it, and then take it out with her mouth and then spit it, expel it into her basket.
What was it like the first time you watched Mabel heal somebody?
Well, I didn't actually want to watch. I was at college, and, you know, growing up again in Santa Rosa in the 60s, you know, you didn't tell people that your stepmother or whatever sucked diseases out of patients' bodies. It wasn't until I got to UCLA and I found people reading Castaneda that people were interested in Indians and expected me to have a vision on the spot. Indians were big business there. So a professor of mine who had done his dissertation on the Pomo knew of Mabel and asked if he could have an audience and watch her doctor. So he came up with me from the college, and we went to Mabel's, and she was doctoring. She was going to doctor a patient. And Mabel set him on the couch behind her where he couldn't see anything, and she put me right in line of everything that was going on, which, of course, I did not want to see. And it was scary and uncomfortable in many ways watching her sing and then go into a trance. And then she said that woman had a pollywog-type trout salmon creature in her, and she said, I'm going to have to take it out. And she, through the ceremony, she sucked that creature out of the woman's eye. And I know this sounds amazing, but she said, okay, you get up here and you come here and witness it. And she'd spit it out into her basket. And I looked, and it was like a newt or something, nothing from this earth, and moving, still alive yet, in that basket.
You know, in hearing you tell stories about healing, I find myself being able to accept the stories as metaphor much more easily than I could accept it as literal truth. And I wonder whether that's just because of my incredible large amounts of skepticism, or whether it's because I'm white and I'm just not a part of Native American traditions. I wonder if you ever went through a phase like that yourself.
Well, we do, but you have to remember, metaphor or not, Terry, language and stories are what define us, whether we know the ways consciously or unconsciously in which they do define us. So you are composed, you are comprised of the stories that make you who you are today. You may not be in touch with those, or you may not think about them consciously, but what happened with your mother and father when you were young, what happened to you as a young woman when you were 16, what happened to you, those are all powerful things. And for us, we're very aware that language and stories are living, and we treat them as living things. For example, Mabel's book, I have to put up a dinner for it every year now. So there'll be a new ceremony in Pomo culture based on that because it's living. So we watch our experience and our language as something living and something that has power. And you know it does, not just for Indians, but for all of us. It's just that in Western society, we don't think about that.
My guest is writer Greg Saris. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Greg Saris. He's the author of two new books, a collection of short stories about California Indians called Grand Avenue, and a biography of a Native American healer and basket weaver called Mabel McKay, Weaving the Dream. I want to talk with you a little bit about your story, particularly the very complicated ethnic story. You were adopted at birth by a white couple.
Right.
And this couple thought that they couldn't have children of their own, but after adopting you, they started actually having biological children.
Three of them, yes.
So did that affect how they treated you once they had children of their own?
Not my mother, not Mary Sarah. She was wonderful. But she was Catholic, and in those days they didn't get divorced. They put up and did all that kind of thing, and it was quite awful. And I think to get me away from her husband, George Saris, who was abusive and drank and had problems besides the fact that he didn't much like me, she began to put me out on farms or let me live with dairy ranchers and horse ranchers and different people at a very early age. Remember, on my birth certificate, and I don't know really to the extent that this bothered George Saris, my adopted father, but it had the name and of my mother and the race. Remember, in the 50s, up until the 50s, I think through the 60s, they had race on your birth certificate. For mother, it had Caucasian in her name, and for father, it had simply unknown non-white.
Because you grew up with different families, you grew up partly in the white world, partly in the Native American world.
Mm-hmm.
Did you never had any sense that you actually were connected by blood to the Native American world?
No, but what I did, well, it was interesting because I had an option as a kid going around on these ranches, and a lot of the ranchers where I worked, the dairy ranch and the horse ranch, they were white families, Italians or whatever. And there was a dairy rancher, and when I loved cows and I wanted to be a dairy rancher and I wanted this guy to be my father, but he had his own son my age, and I was constantly reminded that I was not part of that family, that I was not his son. But when I went to the Indian families, again, much in the way Mabel did, they'd make a place for me at the table. They wouldn't even ask if I wanted food. They'd put the bowl there expecting me to eat. And I felt love. And I mean, there were a lot of problems, the alcoholism and things like that in a lot of these families. But I never felt singled out. I never felt different. I felt incredible love from these people. I felt a bond. I felt that I belonged there. But that was partly because of the way they treated me.
You've since gotten very deep into the Native American part of your identity. In fact, you're now the elected chief of the Coast Miwok tribe. What does it mean to be chief?
People often ask me that. It's not something, you know, they think it's something you inherit, like a crown or something. It's a we're a business, essentially. We're an organized tribe and an organization. And what we do is we have elections every year, Terry, where we elect people to a board. We have a governing board of eight people, and then we have, from that board of the eight elected officials, from the members at large, we then elect a chairman or chief, or a vice chair, a treasurer, and a secretary. And for the last 3 years, I was been elected chairman. I pretty much brought us together. The Miwok people are not acknowledged. We're not federally acknowledged. And one of the battles that I'm working on right now is to petition the BIA to grant us acknowledgement.
What does it mean to not have federal recognition as a tribe?
When you don't have federal recognition as a tribe, when you're not acknowledged, you do not have rights to a land base. You do not have all the other rights and privileges granted Indian peoples of acknowledged tribes, acknowledged nations.
Like what?
For example, we cannot get health care that's set aside for Indian people. We cannot get education benefits that's set aside for Indian people. We do not have land or any kinds of subsidy rights whatsoever. So some of us who are mixed with other Indians, like I also have Pomo in me, we kind of hang on to those that are acknowledged. My Pomo side is acknowledged. My dad was from both tribes of Pomo and the Miwok. But we lose out. So, for example, during the 30s and 40s, when we were very hungry and people were bad off, other Indians were being given blankets and government commodities, foods, and so forth. The Miwok people could not get those.
You've said that being part Indian and part white, you've been privy to both worlds, and you know what each group says about the other. And I wonder if you could share with us something that you think you've learned about what each group thinks of the other.
The white people, the settlers there in Santa Rosa and the descendants of the settlers, basically saw the Pomo Indians as lazy, as shiftless, as people who didn't do anything, who were unmotivated. But beyond that and bigger is that we had a very complicated culture that was predicated on this whole notion, as I said, of poison and respect. Respect for everything around you so that you did not rape the land. I wouldn't go take your acorns or try to rape you because you would have songs and medicine I didn't know about. So I'd leave you alone. We'd stand back. We'd watch other people. And it was because of this profound notion of awe and respect. And again, that's something, Terry, that I think the white world didn't know or didn't understand. We call, in the Kashaya Pomo language, we call white people palachai, which literally translates to miracles. And I used to ask the old people, why do we call white people miracles? And they said, because when the first white people came, we thought they were miraculous. They were going around chopping down trees and killing people and killing the animals, even killing the great grizzly bears, doing all these things. And it didn't come back on them. They just kept coming, more white people. We thought, how can they do this without it coming back on them? But of course, the great irony is, as we know now today, Terry, that it is all coming back on all of us.
Greg Saras is the author of two new books, a collection of short stories about California Indians called Grand Avenue, and a biography of a Native American healer and basket weaver called Mabel McKay, Weaving the Dream. Saras is the elected chief of the Miwok tribe. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have from Haiti?
Well, we'll be hearing about U.S. military actions in Haiti, their efforts to disarm the FRAP, one of the groups of attachés, armed civilians who've been working to assist the military rulers in terrorizing much of the population. Also today, we'll be hearing an outlook of the Supreme Court term with Nina Totenberg, what the big cases are that are likely to be heard this year. Linda Wertheimer talks with David Frum, the author of Dead Right, a book about the Republicans and the conservatives.
Thanks, Robert. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week, our TV critic David Bianculli found a way to watch even more TV and regrets it already.
I shouldn't have done it. I don't go to Vegas or Atlantic City because I know if I start gambling, it's not that easy for me to stop. I've never gone online on a computer network because I know I dive in for hours, and I don't have hours. Just to do my job the way I want to do it, I already watch way too much TV and have no life. But last week, because my local cable company doesn't offer Court TV and I needed it for my O.J. Simpson stories, I broke down and bought a satellite dish. Not one of those new little DBS things, but one of those giant mesh jobbies that can pull in signals all the way from here to Tierra del Fuego. And you can tell by my use of such technical TV terms as giant mesh jobbies that I've got a lot to learn. One of the first things I learned is that there's a whole new world out there. There are 20 satellites, 24 channels on each satellite, and lots of them are showing what are called wild feeds, stuff that isn't scheduled in advance and you just have to stumble on. Channel surfing takes an hour minimum, and there's always something unusual to watch. My first day with the satellite, I caught a wild feed that was just about to start for something called OETV. Now, SCTV I had heard about, but OETV was a mystery. So I slapped in a tape, and it wasn't long before I learned what the OE stood for. The sound on some of these shows is bad, but not as bad as some of these shows.
Welcome to the Ostrich MU television show. I'm Keith Eustace, and I'm here to introduce you to this fascinating look at the ratite industry. These shows contain valuable information from veterinarians, market analysts, researchers, and others. There are stories
out there somewhere, I'm sure, is a farming channel called EIEIO TV. Meanwhile, I found other fun stuff. I saw a news report about traffic conditions in Hong Kong, but didn't really get the point. I caught a live talk show on a new cable network called FX, where the hosts have trouble communicating with their field reporters, and where the idea of a good story is to interview a fan of Gilligan's Island.
John!
Mary Ann. That's kind of what I'm looking for.
John!
The girl
John.
Next door.
John!
Yeah.
Oh, he can hear.
Now we can, are you talking to me?
Yes. Have you ever met, has he ever met any of the cast of Gilligan's Island?
I've met all the cast.
You've
of
met
Gilligan's
them.
Island. That's right. I helped Don Wells, who plays Marianne, and Russell Johnson, who plays the professor, write their books that they just came out with.
Terrific.
Oh, that's great.
How about
Very
that?
Cool. Very cool.
I even stumbled on an unscheduled closed-circuit feed from ABC, where Charlie Gibson of Good Morning America was moderating a phone-in show with the company's top executives. It was for ABC employees, not for TV critics, but I got to eavesdrop anyway.
And again, the calls are anonymous, but we would ask you to identify the division of the company from which you come, just to make sure that the calls come from inside the company and not from somebody who just happens to be watching on satellite.
And early one morning, by accident, I caught an advance feed of that week's new episode of The X-Files on Fox, seeing it about 18 hours earlier than usual.
Scully, are you familiar with subliminal messages?
You mean like sex and ice cubes of liquor ads? That's paranoia.
No, it's a fact that some department stores use subliminal messages in their ambient music to deter shoplifting. And the Russians have been using advanced electroencephalographic techniques to control behavior.
I love The X-Files, and I believe that there are hidden dangers in certain media. For example, I can't turn this satellite dish off. I'm addicted. I need help. Maybe some kind of 12-step program. Except the last thing I need right now is one more program.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our intern is Sienna Chrisman. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.